Yeah, so today's topic is adulting. Dun 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 dun. Pick your favorite example.
Tiger Woods.
Tiger Woods.
That's a bad example.
John Edwards.
That's a bad example.
Elliot Spitzer.
Elliot Spitzer.
That's also a bad example.
Why?
Why? What's your favorite?
Have two wives.
Well.
So technically, not adultery.
Well, modern time, but anyway. pick your example. So I'm going to use this as kind of a broader picture and talk kind of about the Jewish perspective on sexuality. If that's okay with everybody. I'll try not to bore you. Although one time, we were in ninth grade. And my Gemara teacher was trying so hard to keep us interested in our Talmud class, and hard to keep our attention very long. So after like 3-4 months, say, okay, what do you want to talk about? You pick the topic, I'll teach it. So of course, what does every ninth grade boy say they want to learn about? We want to learn about sex, right? Sex in the Talmud, Rabbi. This is fine. So next day he brings in this like very technical Talmudic thing, talking about like, you know, if this one is with that one, and then what are the implications of that, and who, you know, all this stuff, like all very technical legalese, but it was about sexuality, and we all looked at each other and said, "Wow, he can even make sexuality boring." Like, yeah, so it's tough, but I'll try my best to not make sexuality boring. So there's only two words in the Chumash that we're going to look at, so we're not going to look at inside very much. The seventh commandment is lo tinaf. Lo tinaf. Actually, pass. Let me just use Art Scrollies here. So 4:10. So we'll see. There's a bit of a discussion as to what this is referring to. Right here, you shall not commit adultery. We'll see that there are definitely commentaries who broaden this to not just be about adultery per se, but kind of a general overview of a prohibition of sexual immorality. So we'll get into that. But we definitely need a little perspective on all this. Now, there's many different reasons why this would be prohibited. It's interesting that, you know, we take this for granted as a society. And it's actually, I think, one of the bigger debates that we have today, in an interesting way, is the concept of marriage is really a big debate. The importance of marriage, what does it mean to be married? And as much as there is a debate, there seems to be an underlying consensus that marriage is important, that marriage is part of society, part of community. And, you know, with every scandal that we have, every, you know, adultery scandal that's out there, there does seem to be an uproar through and through. People are quitting, people are resigning, people are going into hiding, they're going into sex addiction therapy, which we'll get to. Right? So, there is this reaction, right? There is, at least in America, there is an assumption that marriage is an ideal, that this is something that as a society we should not only support, but someone who does not live up to, is not faithful in their marriage, there's something that they're doing objectively wrong. Okay. Now, in other societies, it's not taken quite as seriously, right? This was a big debate even 12 years ago, right? When was Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky? 98, 99, right around that time. So that was the big debate. The big debate at the Shabbos table was, what do you expect? Is he really any worse than anybody else? Wouldn't most men in that situation do the same thing? Isn't that exactly what John F. Kennedy did? And that debate has just continued on over the past decade, really. Just, yeah, replace Bill Clinton with person X, right? And of course, Tiger Woods being the latest. In the Jewish community, there's been their, you know, scandals as well. So it's something that we're grappling with consistently. In one sense, we as a society agree that marriage isn't ideal, that marriage is important, that it's a fair expectation that somebody would live up to those, you know, that a person would be faithful in their marriage. But at the same time, there is a recognition that this is a complicated situation, right? That marriage is, by definition, especially in modern society, a very dicey and complicated situation. And adultery is a part of that mix, right? And obviously, there are many other reasons why marriages succeed and fail, but this tends to be pretty much at the top of the list. I mean, if I'd say there's two things that objectively someone would say a divorce is warranted, it would be abuse and adultery. That would probably be the top two things. I don't know if anything else would even go in, you know, in that category. Everything else is more subjective, irreconcilable differences, we don't get along, whatever it is. But those two things seem to be objectively, you know, a reason to get divorced. So we have to grapple with this reality. Now, it's so complicated for many reasons. Number one, as we'll see, and we've talked about this a little bit already, is the Yetzirah, the desire or the natural inclination towards sexuality, is extremely strong. And the way the Talmud puts it, it is, seems to be our strongest Yetzirah. And there are many different aspects to it. You know, sexuality is not just about one thing. It's about a lot of things. It's about power. It's about ego. It's about attraction. It's about desire. It's about self-worth. It's about a number of different things, all intertwined into one. And when it comes to marriages, especially, this becomes a very complicated part of marriage because it's intertwined within it. Actually, it was... a few months back, when I was at the rabbinic conference, and this was one of the major items we had in our agenda, is sexuality today, because it's such a big issue, and the Jewish community is no different in the sense that we're exposed for the most part to everything that everyone else is exposed to, and the values of this society is you know, this society has not figured out sexuality at all. At all. If anything, I think we're more immature about sexuality today than we ever were. It's interesting, as much as we feel like we advance as a society, we advance technologically, we advance civil rights, all of these things, when it comes to sexuality today, I think it's almost as immature as you could possibly get. You just have to turn on, you watch the late night TV shows, you watch also, I mean... The jokes about sexuality are lowest common denominator, you know, haha, this one's gay, haha, they're sleeping around, haha. I mean, it seems that we haven't moved beyond, you know, even the most basic level of maturity when it comes to sexuality today. And I think that's really everywhere. And it's the most shocking thing, and it's the thing that's easiest to get people's attention. So... It's going to be pervasive in advertising on the internet, especially where everyone's goal is to get your attention so you click here. So we're trying to find a reason for you to click here. And that's, you know, so we'll do whatever we can to get you to click here. So we want to shock and we want to attract you and we want to get your attention as much as possible. So we're shouting out and there's, you know, there's shouts from all over, you know, all over us. There's people shouting at us. Subliminally, you know, give me your attention, give me your attention. And this gets people attention. And I think the Tiger Woods scandal really just showed how pervasive this is. How fascinated people were, how interested people for weeks. When I was reading that, there was the New York Post had 19 consecutive cover stories about Tiger Woods and 18 consecutive cover stories about 9/11. That it was literally the longest string of cover stories about one story. I mean, it's a story. It's interesting. It's fine. But it just captivated the entire nation's attention for a good 3 weeks. You know, we joked about it here in the class a couple times. But it's unbelievable how interested people are. And we can't move beyond that. So we have to understand what this is. Because I don't think we understand what this is fully. And the more we understand what this yetzer hara for sexuality is, the better chance we have of dealing with it in some sort of productive way. But until that point, we're just going to have more of the same, kind of this immature approach to sexuality. Okay. So, let's begin from there. Now, there's a few different reasons given why adultery is such a big prohibition. Why is adultery so important? So, the Chinuch, the Sefer Chinuch, which gives reasons for the mitzvah, so he gives a very practical explanation, which has broader consequences. He says that it's essential that you clamp down on adultery because you need to know who the parents are. And if you don't know who the parents are, society is going to break down pretty quickly. So, in order to make sure you know who the father is, so we better keep couples together and apart from other people. Because if you don't have a ban on adultery and everyone's sleeping with everybody else and it's open season, then you don't know who the father is, and pretty soon, as a society, you're lost. Not only that, but, you know, two commandments ago, we were talking about the mitzvah of honoring your parents. Well, it's a hard thing to honor your parents if you don't know who they are. Right? It's a hard thing. And the breakdown of a society very often can be the lack of fatherhood, right?
You're talking about a child born possibly out of wedlock, but to a married couple.
Exactly, right.
Then the child is presumed to be the child of that marriage.
So halachically, in American law, yeah, we have certain assumptions. But if we know that things are just, there's rampant adultery, and there's mistrust and doubt within the family,
it's not gonna
end well. And certainly, if that's happening in marriage, it's happening outside of marriage, and pretty soon you have a mess. The family structure is essential in the Torah's view, because the only people who are going to, you need parents to look after the children. That's the way Hashem creates society, that parents are built to look after their children as well as anybody else. Not every parent is perfect. Actually, every parent is imperfect, but at least they care, and at least they try, and at least they do the best for their children, and there aren't too many things a parent can do that can mess up their child for life. There's a few things, but most things that most parents do aren't going to mess up the children for life. Parents are imperfect, and eventually the kids realize it. But when you don't have that, that's when you really have a big problem. And I thought it was fascinating because during the last election, that's one thing that Obama really came out strongly about. I forgot who he was speaking to. I don't want to get it wrong. But he made a big deal about one of the biggest problems in the African-American community today is the high percentage of single mothers. It's one of the biggest problems. And the fathers not taking responsibility for their own children is a big breakdown in society, and that has all sorts of consequences to it. There's lack of role models, then perpetuates itself, the next generation does the same thing, and you have a mess of a society, and that was one of his biggest points in his campaign. So that's the Sefer Chinuch's opinion on adultery. So that's just I wanted to mention that because that's certainly a part of this picture. The Evan Ezra, though, in the commentaries here in the Torah, so he looks at it in a much broader scope, and he really wants to make sure we realize this isn't just talking about adultery; it's talking about all sorts of sexual immorality as well. He says, "Rabim chashu ki eniyav ki im eshet ish." Most people think that this is only about with a married woman, bavur shematzu asher yinaf. At the end of the day, he says, "But kimat ham lomer za acher shamar asher yinaf at eshet ish." So it says, "Vein perishok asher chashru," and he goes through all the other prohibitions that the Torah has of sexual immorality. There's incest, and there's married women who are in status of nida, and goes through all these different things. But his point is that it's true that the prohibition here, in one sense, is about adultery, but it's not. It's about all of sexual morality. It's about keeping sexuality in a perspective that's functional for society and not destructive for society. And that's the ultimate goal of the Torah. So, and basically, this is probably the most impractical demand Hashem could have on us. Now, why is that? Why is this such an impractical demand? So let's go through a few examples. Just, you know, let's discuss what we're up against. Okay? So there's a few fascinating statements in the Talmud as to what we're up against. Number one, Rabbi Akiva. So Rabbi Akiva was one of the most preeminent sages in the Talmud, one of the most well-respected and almost a sagely character, the way he's described throughout the Talmud. 24,000 students, world-renowned, one of the leaders of the Jewish people in every respect. So this is what the Talmud writes. It's in the Babylonian Talmud, Kiddushin 81a. Rabbi Akiva was accustomed to scoff at sinners. Basically, he didn't understand how people were living their life and constantly, the way it's put, giving into their Yitzhahara. Meaning, they kept giving into temptation and they weren't able to control themselves. And Rabbi Akiva would look at them and say, look, I can't believe that they're so weak. Right? He didn't understand how they were so weak. They just keep on messing up their lives. One day the Satan is kind of the external influence, right? What this means exactly, I mean, in English that's been translated to Satan in today's language, but not Satan in the Christian sense. It's the desire for temptation. So one day the Satan appeared to Rabbi Akiva as a woman perched atop a palm tree. So it's not clear if this was just some sort of mirage that he saw, it seemed like some sort of mirage, right? That somehow the Yetzirah, which we'll talk a little bit more about later, that's kind of inside of us, was showing him this vision of this beautiful woman perched atop a palm tree. So he held on to the palm tree and began to ascend it. Basically, the Yetzirah turned up the thermostat. Okay? Normally we're at 70 degrees, right? And then the Yetzirah wanted to prove a point. So it turned up the heat to 95, right? Oh, you like it hot, right? You know, like in The Simpsons, right? Where Homer goes to hell, right? What's hell for him? Oh, you like donuts, do you? And, you know, so I'll give you all the donuts in the world. And let's see if you can eat donuts. Ends up he could eat them for hours, right? So you think Rabbi Akiva, that you have tremendous self-control? Well, I'm going to turn up the pressure to a point when you can't handle it anymore, right? That's what the Yetzirah does. So he held on to the palm tree and began to ascend it. When he reached the middle of the tree, the Yetzirah released him and said, had it not been proclaimed in heaven, be cautious of Rabbi Akiva and his Torah learning, I would have made your life worth two ma'ah, or two worthless coins. I mean, the Yetzirah says, I was nice to you, right? This was just a test. But if I really wanted, at any point, to turn up the heat even more, I could have done it, right? So,
was this before the Bar Kokhba rebellion or after?
I assume it's before. I mean, we're not giving any time period for this. So it seems, number one, that Rabbi Akiva had to understand. Now, Rabbi Akiva had worked on himself and refined himself to the point when he was able to lower the intensity of the desire. Now, it's not clear how old he was, because this also could be he's older. If someone's older, you know, and you know, they're... passions are not as intense. Some in their 60s might not be much different than someone in their 30s, you know. It might not be that much of a difference. So here the Yetzirah is proving the point that basically we it can make it as difficult as possible. And as we talked about a few weeks ago, the Talmud, you know, that says that that the Jewish people around the time of the Second Temple, they prayed that the desire for sexuality would be taken away from them. So they realized very quickly that wasn't practical. So they had to deal with it. But they realized that having this desire for sexuality was just going to cause... was going to cause trouble in the long run, and it constantly does. And there's a few other... You know, I'll give you a second example. This is from the Talmud in Sanhedrin. So when we look at the Torah, it's also interesting to note how many great people in the Torah give in to their sexuality or make huge mistakes with their sexuality. You can give me some examples, and you know, off the top of your heads, who would you name?
David.
Okay, so we have King David. Yeah. Okay, we'll discuss that story.
Shimshon. Solomon?
Right, Shimshon, right? And Delilah.
Yehuda
and Tamar.
I know them all.
Right? I mean, that's already three. That's already three pretty prominent people. Shlomo, right? King Shlomo, King Solomon.
Well, he married them, though.
What?
He married them.
Right, but ends up being that his undoing, and, yeah. You know, right? And, you know, there's certainly more examples than that. So let's take King David's example. What's the example of King David? So just to review, the story is that King David saw Bathsheba and was attracted to her. He was the king, and so he was, you know, he wanted to marry her. Only one problem, she was already married. So what do you do when you're the king? When you're the king, you have a lot of options. So he sent her husband out to war, kind of made sure he was near the front lines. Her husband dies in battle, and then he marries her.
Well, that was after the mistake.
Well, that's, you know, intertwined to within it. So, obviously, and then there's a whole process of tshuva, repentance, that David goes through. You know, what legally what he did was, technically, he had the legal right to do that as a king, but still, obviously, that was not the right thing to do. So how did this whole thing start? Right? How did this whole thing start? So the Talmud gives a very interesting beginning to this story. So this is in the Talmud in Sanhedrin 107, Kuf Zayin. So it happened towards evening that David arose from the bed and strolled on the roof of the king's house. From atop of the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. That's the quote from the prophet from the book of Samuel. The Samuel 2, chapter 11, verse 2. Rabbi Judah said, David changed the nature of his sexual behavior, lying with his wife during the day instead of at night. And then Rashi adds, figuring this way, he'd satiate his sexual desire early, so it wouldn't interfere with his daily activities. But he forgot a simple law. If you attempt to feed your desires, they become hungrier. And if you starve them, they cease to become hungry. And this is an interesting lesson. But first we see the power of sexuality, especially with a person like David, is that his Yitzhahara didn't play tricks on him. This was a natural occurrence. And this isn't like Rabbi Akiva, who was manipulated, artificially. King David, this happens naturally. What happens? He forgets a simple law. And the way it's put it, if you attempt to feed your desires, they become hungry, and if you starve them, they cease to become hungry. And this ends up being kind of a motto, a paradigm of controlling sexuality. That there has to be, as opposed to eating or something like that, where you eat and now you're hungry, you know, you're hungry so you eat and now you're not hungry anymore. When it comes to desire, so that's it doesn't work that way. It works quite the opposite. That you can't ever quench, you can't ever quench the thirst. You can't ever kill the beast, right? It doesn't exist. Because the beast always comes back. And, you know, when we talk about sexual addiction, so that was this big debate I was hearing on the, talk radio and all these places, and, Tiger Woods going to his kind of sex addiction, right? So as we know about drug addiction, we know about alcohol addiction, but sexual addiction, that's a cop-out, right? That can't be real. So it is and it isn't, right? It's real in the sense that you can be addicted to pretty much anything. There's chemical addiction, right? There's addicted to drugs, to cigarettes, to alcohol, but there's also psychological addiction, and there's emotional addiction, and there's dependency and all sorts of things. Could be shoe shopping, right? It could be TV watching. It could be pick whatever people like to do. Gambling.
Chocolate.
What? Chocolate, right. Overeating. Gambling. Gambling is not it's not a chemical addiction. You're addicted to the high of it. You're addicted to the rush of it. You're addicted to the action. That's what, the gamblers have a hard time. They can't replace that in any other part of their life. It's so exciting. What else could be that exciting? Nothing. I'm bored without it. My life is not interesting without it. Right? You see that, rock and roll stars. They go to drugs and sex. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll go together. Because what do you do the other 23 hours of the day when you're not in front of 5,000, 10,000 screaming fans playing music. How do you match that in any other way in your life? Right? Once you're used to that rush, you're addicted to it. You're addicted to that rush. You're addicted to that energy. You need to replace it with something. There has to be something else in life that can give you that. So sexuality can be that same thing. So in many ways, it can end up being a rush. It can be just something to get you interested and excited. So in that sense, there is an addiction to a certain extent. That's not addiction like a chemical addiction, but it is an addiction, really. In the end, it is. I mean, addiction is something that, you know, for a number of reasons, you really need intervention to stop doing in a way that's going to be detrimental to you. And this ends up being one of the, you know, certainly for men, one of the main ways that people bring around their own downfall, because they're addicted to it. They're addicted to the ramifications of it. So how do we deal with this? So basically what I've proven so far is that we have this extremely strong desire that so strong that in our history, one of our greatest, the members of the Jewish tribe, Ezra, asked Hashem, please get rid of this desire from us because it's too hard and we keep sinning. One of the temples is destroyed partly because of sexual immorality. Throughout the Torah, we have story after story after story of individuals and the people as a whole sinning because of this. Yeah?
Sorry. What was the temple destroyed partly because of sexual immorality?
Well, that's one of the, you know, that's one of the reasons given for the destruction of the of the first temple.
Oh.
You know, of idol worship and sexual immorality and kind of the big sins, quote unquote. So here we have this monster, right? This monster of desire. So how do we counteract that, right? And to complicate it, it's also so complicated because it's a mitzvah. Because it's a mitzvah, right?
Comment?
Yeah.
No, I was sitting and listening, and you said, well, how do we get rid of sexuality? And we pray for getting rid of it. And I mean, if you get rid of it, then you get rid of it altogether.
Right. So we realized...
What about, you know, your wife, family?
Oh, okay, so that's what we're going to get to, right. Uh-huh. So meaning, we tried to get rid of it, that didn't work, and that was not going to be productive, because then the world will cease to exist. Within one. Right. So we know that we need it. And we'll see that it's essential to life, and it's essential to a person's happiness in many ways. But at the same time, it's such a strong desire that you can easily get pushed over the edge. So here we have something that we have to balance. Now, when it comes to the other prohibitions in the Ten Commandments, right? Don't kill. Okay, I'll never kill. Deal. Don't steal. Great, I won't steal from people. Done. Right? Don't bear false witness. Okay, I won't do it. Never do it. Never do it. Never murder someone. Got it. No exceptions. Fine. This is, you know, if someone's in danger, you can kill them. Fine. If you're in danger, you can kill them. Well, fine. There's some explanations when self-defense or we are at war. But we understand, you know, and we don't have a desire to the same extent to go around killing people. You're right. Every once in a while, you're like, I want to kill that person. Or every once in a while, you think about stealing something, and there is a desire for it to a certain extent. But there's never a mitzvah to steal. Right? There's never a mitzvah to kill, again, unless you're at war or some extreme situation. But in daily, regular life, these aren't things that we encounter on a regular basis. As opposed to adultery, which is... Sexuality is something we encounter on a daily basis, and it's a mitzvah. And in other circumstances, it's a mitzvah. So obviously, there's something there of value, and yet we have to control it and put it in its proper place. So that's... I'm just saying what makes it such a big challenge and so different than the other commandments is that this is a balancing act versus a prohibition, never do this, got it, right? Okay.
Can we, like, this? I mean, I guess it's over understood what adultery is. But in the times where, I don't know, like a long time ago, like Jewish men had multiple wives. So what is adultery? Is it like sleeping with someone who's already married? or if you have a spouse and you're with someone who's not married, that's okay.
Okay, so it's a little bit of both. So to sleep with someone who is married, for a married woman to sleep, if a married woman sleeps with a man who is married or not married, they're both guilty of adultery. Okay? I mean, you can be guilty of adultery if you're not married. Sleeping with a married woman is adultery for the single male as well.
Is it vice versa, or is it only...
Neil alluded to before, the only complexity is that in the times of the Torah, you could marry more than one woman, but there had to be a context of marriage in place, meaning there had to be the intention of marriage. So, meaning you could have slept with someone and not have a marriage. So it wouldn't be adultery per se, but it would be, you know, something else. However, by the Middle Ages, certain Ashkenazi communities, when they banned polygamy, so then it's basically a form of adultery. And in modern times, we don't really make these differentiations in any meaningful way. It's not all that relevant to, you know, to how we behave today. We don't say, oh, that's okay. He can have more than one wife, right? Like, you don't hear that in any community today. Technically, there are differences, but practically, they're treated basically.
One big difference is that if a married woman had a baby with a single woman, that is wife.
Single man. What?
The married man, he had an affair with a single woman.
They know the baby. They know the father was.
You know, but he's not a mamzer.
No, you're right. There are differences, but I'm saying for the purpose of our discussion, it's not going to... Yeah, not gonna make that much of a difference.
So, does this apply mostly to women, or like, I guess that's the thing. Like, if a married man sleeps with a non-married woman, is he committing adultery?
No.
It's not the Torah's adultery. It's like it's rabbinic adultery.
Oh, okay.
Right.
But okay.
It's not a technicality more. I'm saying it's not.
And so, is there a reason why there's that distinction?
Well, men could have more than one wife, and there were societies when that was
acceptable
and even desirable. And there are more men, more women than men, you know. And it's worked in many societies. Men maybe would die more than others. I don't know. I guess women die in childbirth, men die at war, but it was an acceptable practice. So. That's the main reason why. You know, you almost never see polygamy with multiple men married to the same woman.
So with King David, it wasn't really adultery because her husband died, even though he kind of technically sent him to get killed. Sort of.
At that point, it wasn't adultery, but what he did was...
It was more like murder.
So again, it wasn't technically murder, but it was as close as you can get to murder without it being murder. Right. I mean, again, legally he was within his rights, but it was a misuse of power. Let's put it that way. It was a misuse of power, and that's what he gets, you know, taken to task for. Okay. So I think what's essential nowadays is more. It's interesting because. While there's so much talk about sexuality, I feel like there needs to be more talk about sexuality, right? But not the way it's been, and not the way it typically happens. I think the key, at least certainly in our society, to be able to deal with this better, is more of an education as to what are fair sexual expectations, and to educate people about what this is. It's interesting because. Whenever I meet with a prospective bride and groom, we actually discuss this in pretty great, you know, I think it's important that everybody understands some basic things. And the Torah goes out of its way, in many respects, to say how sexuality is essential to a marriage. I mean, when it comes to, you know, Nida, so when a woman is menstruating, she is... she and her husband can't be together, right? They can't physically be together during that time. And when she gets out of that state, then she goes to the mikvah, and then they can be together again. That And there's a certain process they have to go through. They have to make sure that she's no longer menstruating. But we go out of our way to make sure that we're not too strict on the couple, right? And if you read the way the halacha in the Shulchan Aruch, throughout the halacha, the way it discusses it, it's viewed as a very big deal to say a woman is prohibited to be with her husband for even one extra day, right? We say it's an issue in Shalom Bayit. It's a huge factor in the happiness of the couple, which shows us that obviously this is essential to the happiness of a marriage. In order for a marriage to go well, there has to be intimacy that goes well. So I mean, ultimately, to combat adultery and all that's going on today, there has to be a serious discussion, there has to be serious effort in the couple that their sex life is going well. In this society, if a couple is not, if they are not physically, if it's not working physically, they are in trouble. They are in serious trouble. When they are married, of course. They're in serious trouble. Because at that point, there's too much happening in this society, there's too much going on, that it's really going to make it very difficult. And I think prospective brides and prospective grooms have to really understand the nature of sexuality of the other gender, right? Because what we often do in life is we assume that the other person's experience is just like our experience, when very rarely is that the case. Because we project our own experiences onto other people. And men and women have very different natures when it comes to sexuality. And the way I usually put it is that for men, sex is not just a physical act. It's interesting because women typically understand that for men, sex is like a physical act, right? Men are like animals, right? As a society, that's the perspective. Men are uncontrollable animals. And so every once in a while, you know, so they have to, you know, appease them. Otherwise, you know, they're going to, you know, act like gorillas or something, right? Right, that's kind of the perspective. Men are uncontrollable. Tiger Woods, all men are like that. You give a man a chance, he would do anything, right? You can forget it. A man can never say no. That's kind of the perspective that you hear over and over and over again. But what's interesting is that, believe it or not, men actually feel love. Believe it or not, men actually have the concept of love for men, not just for women. But for men, it's much harder for men to feel love without a physical element. Very, very difficult. While women could have a 2-hour conversation and feel closer to their
wedding dress,
right. So she can have a 2-hour conversation about anything and feel closer to her boyfriend, fiance, husband after that experience. It's very hard for him to feel significantly closer to her through a conversation. Yes.
On that argument, I mean, I would say maybe it's the opposite for men, because I guess you're saying that they have to feel, like, they have to have the sexual attraction, like, to feel love, but at the same time, they can separate it much better than women, because, like, committing adultery is not only about love, it's more of sexual desire. You don't necessarily love the other woman.
Well, it's true, but believe it or not, men can fall in love through sex very quickly. They can, or what they perceive to be love, very quickly. Because once they're physically connected, you know, once they're physically attracted and involved with a woman, they can. In some ways, they can get just as emotionally attached to her as she can get attached to him.
It's infatuation.
Infatuation, because it's very hard, certainly over a long period of time. Even for men, to be with a woman physically and have no emotional attachment. Now, it's true, to a certain extent, men can do that, but usually they're fooling themselves. You know, even men who are even doing something that would clearly have no connection to an emotional attachment to a woman, mm-hmm. there's still an element of an emotional attachment to a woman involved. Even, you know, prostitution, strip clubs, things like that, it's not only about physical desire. And that's typically what people assume, but I really do not think that's the case. I think there's a strong element in any situation that men do want an emotional connection with women. The difference is, there are many men, it's very difficult for them to do that. And so those are those are ways of fooling themselves into thinking that there's some sort of attachment to this. Women are pretending to be, you know, attached to them when they're not. But it's not so simple, you know. Men do have a stronger physical component, but there's a lot of emotion and love involved in it. That's what I'm saying.
What do you define love?
I'm saying there's an emotional connection more than just a physical connection. Okay. That's what I would say. Let's not use the word love. And I think that's misunderstood. And I think it's important that women understand that. Because, you know, women in a relationship have to realize that that there has to be a strong physical relationship, or the relationship is doomed from his end. It's doomed. I mean, especially in this day and age, especially with all that's going on out there. Now, it's definitely true that, you know, that men are more attracted to physicality. And, you know, look, women know that. They do their best to appeal to male's attractiveness to physicality. That's how it works, right? Look, that's how the game is played. The woman's job is to attract. The men's job is to respond to that attraction. And, you know, everything flows from that.
Yeah, but there's also mutual attraction.
There is. But for women, it's much more about themselves. Right? It's much more about their attraction versus... I mean, for a woman, typically, it's more important for her to feel attractive than for her to be attracted to the man. Because that can happen very naturally in a number of ways.
I don't know if that's a rule. I don't know if that's necessarily true. But I do agree that men are more attracted to physicality than women.
Right.
But I also know a lot of women that are.
For sure. I'm not, look.
But I think it's like, if you want to make a...
And there are men who care a lot how they look, right? And there are women who care a lot about, you know, how attractive the male is, for sure. But...
I think it's like...
As a general rule.
As a general rule, it's much more important for the women, for her to feel attractive. Mm-hmm. It's not as important for him to feel attractive. He doesn't have to feel attractive usually. He has to feel competent. He has to feel important. Power. He has to feel powerful. Whatever it is, there are many things.
That is
the attraction, right? But that's not attractiveness, right? That's a different element. Him feeling that I look good today is not as relevant. It's relevant, obviously. You can't go out and not care about that. It's relevant, but for her, it's much more relevant, right? Meaning, you'll never hear a guy say, right, I don't want to have sex because I feel fat. Right? That doesn't make sense to a male. Right? Well, what's the difference? How I feel. Right? What do you mean I feel fat about myself? Who cares? Like, you know, she's fine with it, I'm fine with it. Right? For women, that concept makes sense. I can't do this because I don't feel pretty. Right? That's a female concept. Men can relate to that concept. But every female can relate to that concept. Because how she looks at her own physical attraction is completely relevant to this discussion, you know, to her ability to feel attractive. So,
I have a headache.
What? Well, that's a separate. There can be a lot of reasons for that. So that's important. So it's important for number one, for men to understand, for women to understand that for men this isn't just a purely physical act, but this is how they feel love, and for men to understand about women. That this is an expression of love. It's also very essential for women. But women can feel love in a multitude of ways, more ways than men can. Men can have a hard time having a two-hour conversation and feeling more in love after that. Usually after a two-hour conversation, they're exhausted and burnt out, and, oh my God, I can't believe we just talked for 2 hours. Right? And that's much harder. So, and for women, the importance of their own attractiveness is very important. And for men to recognize their attractiveness is very important. I was interesting. I was listening. I don't know what station this was on. This was like 4 years ago. And somehow this caller calls up this, you know, talk radio station and talks how he had been, you know, the topic ended up becoming sexless marriages. That ended up being the topic.
Sex what?
Sexless marriages.
That's the bad. So the startup where Julia works, they have like support groups, and the big one of the biggest groups is that group.
Yeah.
Oh really?
Like it, 10,000 people.
Just locally or nationally?
Nationally.
Yeah. It's a surprisingly large number of people. At least that's the way it seemed, because all these people start calling you with their stories. Mm-hmm. And the host, you know, who was married and, you know, had a very hard time understanding it. Basically, you had, you know, we have sex once a year. I haven't had sex in 10 years. You know, and all these stories were coming out. And I can't, you know, that is the very definition of hell on earth. I mean, that is a dysfunctional marriage at its very core. Because if the couple can't physically get together, and there's a number of reasons why that might be, but that is, you know, the beginning of the end, or in many ways. So, like, one woman called in, and she seemed to not understand this point at all. So she said, we have sex once a year on my husband's birthday. Mm-hmm. Right? On my husband's birthday. So once a year on my husband's birthday, that's when we have sex. And he said, that's it? He said, yeah, I'm not really even into it then, so I just lie there, but he doesn't really care. What's the difference to him? As long as I'm there, he's fine. And the host was, but like, the host was trying to explain to her very smartly. He said, no, you don't understand. Like, he actually cares that you're interested, right? That's relevant to his experience, right? And, you know, very often, you know, what's most attractive, what men want more than anything, is that women are attracted, that the women are excited, that the women are into it. That is end up being the most essential element of attraction for men. So it's very important, and it's not enough for a woman to just say, "Well, I'll do this for him because I know it's my responsibility," or "All right, I know I have to do this, so I'll do it." If she herself is not feeling attraction, if she herself has, you know, no interest whatsoever, then the marriage is just as doomed. It's not enough to just play the part or to fill it, you know, and that's very important. So my point is that these, as much as we talk about sex, these are conversations that are very difficult for women and men to have together. Very, very difficult. One of the most difficult conversations to have. And it's awkward and it's difficult, but ultimately these are the things that that make kind of a foundation of a marriage. They just did the Orthodox Union did this marriage survey. It's very interesting. Actually, Dr. David Pelkovitz, who was one of the leading people on the marriage survey, is going to be our scholar in residence in a week and a half. He's going to speak at the internet conference, and he's going to be here, and he's going to talk about his Shabbat morning. Drash will be about the findings of the marriage survey and what they learned from it. And when they discussed, you know, the elements that lead to a happy marriage, a satisfied sex life was second or third. I mean, it was literally second or third.
What are the first two?
Gosh, I don't remember. I think communication.
Money?
Money's that. I don't remember how it was worded.
But it's not this
first, second, and third. They all equal.
I mean, but they're all very close. It was like the top three are very close. Yeah.
But so you started saying about how a lot of these things we don't talk, like as a society we don't talk about, and that we should have like education. Like, I guess the big question is like, where does that education come from? Because a lot for parents it's like awkward, at least in, I don't know, I think for the most part, not a general.
So like, yeah, I can't like, talk.
At home it's something that parents usually like avoid, and then at school, you could learn about health, like in sex and the health perspective, like disease.
I mean, all I can say is that as a rabbi, I think the rabbi who's marrying a couple has to have a talk with the couple before the marriage.
But by that time, do you think it might be too late?
Game.
Well, it is. No, you're right. But I mean, like, you can't have these conversations with 15-year-olds either. I mean, this is what's important in it, you know. Like, it's a little premature also. I mean, there has to be sexual responsibility at younger ages, but when a couple, look, I mean, there's different societies. I'm thinking in terms of, you know, but in the society, you know, the modern Orthodox society, couples are, you know, not having sex before they're married, so in that sense, it's not too late. But you're right, in many societies today that, you know, it's later in the game, but still, You can have that conversation, I think, at any point, and it can be just as relevant, and the message can be, you know. I mean, if you've already established bad habits, it might be a little harder to sure. change perspective, but still, it's doable. I mean, but I think it's a conversation that has to happen more and more today. And that the couples have to have more and more today. Yeah.
Two books by Shmulian, right on the subject. Very good.
Yeah, I remember I read part of the first one. I don't know, what's the second one?
Kosher Sutra.
Oh, I didn't know about that one. I didn't even know that one existed.
I don't know what that is.
I'll tell you, he comes up with good titles. He's like, I'll give him that.
What's the other one?
Kosher Sex.
Kosher Sex was the first one. That came out in the late 90s. That's really like at least 10 years old. 10,
Kosher
12 years
Sutra
old.
Kosher Sutra came out a few years ago.
Really?
You know, right? Yeah.
Okay.
And he's...
He's found his niche. So I give him credit for that.
No, but they are very good one, and it's from...
So much travel one time.
Oh, yeah?
So I'm on Channel 2.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he does all these talk shows and this
stuff. Right. 2 in the morning? Did you?
So, and also the flip side. I think also what people have to realize is that too often, you know, there's a certain ideal that's portrayed over and over and over again, especially in the media. And this, I think, is what's very difficult, especially for kids, is the ideal of the womanizing male and the sexy, attractive woman, right? Those ideals are portrayed over and over and over again. And those go, I think those go back many, many decades, right? You think about James Bond, right? What is James Bond? I mean, James Bond is the beginning of this concept, right? James Bond is a few things, right? He's powerful,
well,
he's risk-taking. Even before, what's the good example before that?
I don't know, in the medieval times, they did all the jousting to win the girl.
Right. But what does James Bond... Okay, what does James Bond do and what does he not do? What does James Bond never do?
Get married.
Right? Seriously. James Bond does not get married. Because the moment James Bond gets married, the movies are over. Because nobody wants to see a married James Bond. Nobody wants to see James Bond taking that call, yeah, and they'll be home at 10, right? No. If you're James Bond, you have to be suave, you have to be debonair, you have to be risk-taking, and you have to...
have a Bond girl every...
Right, you have to have a new girl every single time, right? Because you can. Because you're cool, and because you're tough, and because you're so darn interesting and attractive that no one can resist you. That is the idea, right? That's the concept. James Bond doesn't work if he's married, right? In the Westerns, right, you know? It doesn't work if they're married, right? Nobody wants to see, or Han Solo, any of these people. Nobody wants to see a married Han Solo. What's interesting, Star Wars, come on, right? Right? And, you know, you can come up with your own example.
Darth Vader is not married.
Well, that's why, you know, he was. That's the whole thing. Right?
Oh, that's true.
Right, right. The evil one was married, right? And marriage caused him to become evil, right? That's the lesson of Star Wars. Nobody wants to be married James Bond. It's not interesting, it's not exciting, it's boring. Because once James Bond is married, he's now not independent. He's now controlled by a woman. Mm-hmm. He's now, right? He's not James Bond anymore. What?
He has to be home.
He has to be home at 11, right?
He has to take out the garbage.
He has to take out the garbage, right? Nobody wants to see James Bond taking out the garbage. James Bond, right? And the flip side as well, right? The sexy, attractive woman, who, right? And all the Bond girls, right? And, you know, in modern times, the Britney Spears or whoever it is in, you know, I don't even know. Taylor Swift, I know she is. I don't really know what her reputation is. I don't think she has like that kind of. Anyway, right? But that's also an ideal, right? That's also an ideal, and so that idealization is certainly, you know, there's a breakdown because both of those lead into the things we talked about before, right? It's basically the essence of what attracts men and what attracts women. What attracts women? Power. And elusiveness and control, and right, and that's what attracts men. You know, she's pretty, she's good looking, and she dresses seductively. Boom, we got it, right? Now let's make a movie. I mean, that's, you know, that's cookie cutter stuff. What they don't show is You know, they don't show James Bond when he's 55 years old, right? They don't show James Bond when he's losing his hair. But I saw the site once. You know, someone sent me this email. Burt Berenfuss, he likes to send these emails. And it's like, he showed, it's like movie stars today, like movie stars from previous generations and how they look today. And they had like Peter O'Toole and they had Sean Connery.
He's still attractive.
But yeah, like, you don't want to see him with his shirt off, let's put it that way.
The best Bond ever.
He was the best.
No, you're right, but I'm saying,
but anyway,
but you don't remain James Bond forever.
With his gut and with white
exactly.
hair, without teeth.
Right, it's not right. Meaning that doesn't, you know, that doesn't last forever. But even more than that...
Or Britney Spears when she's like 50.
Right, exactly.
Without plastic
surgery. Well, right, they become less interesting at that point. So, yeah, but one thing that I think is not mentioned enough is the offshoot of all this. Meaning, the Yetzer Hara is very good at making us believe that things are going to be more valuable and they're going to be more interesting than they really are, right?
Sure.
So the Yetzer Hara does a fantastic job of convincing us that this is an ideal, that this will not just make you happy, but that there's something there. When ultimately, so you know something is Yetzer Hara based when it seems really, really important, and after you've done it, you realize that there was nothing there at all, right? And certainly when it comes to empty sex, that's really what it is. It's ultimately, you know, no one feels good the day after, right? Nobody feels good the night of the day after. Nobody feels good, right? It's guilt, it's emptiness, it's like, you know, it was all for nothing. Because it's a lead up to a moment because you're chasing, and then when you get there, it's fool's gold. So in order for sexuality to be... to really be lasting and to really work is it to be within a context where there's meaning behind it. Right? And that's ultimately, you know, what the Torah wants. And, you know, the Torah is not saying don't commit adultery because we want you to be miserable. The point is to be happier. You will be happier, and study after study shows that couples in committed, happy relationships, their sex lives are much better than the single person who is sleeping around. They're much more satisfied in their relationships. You know, consistently so. Right? Consistently so. Because you don't feel guilty the day after. Because...
But take Tiger Woods. I don't think he feels guilty. I think the only thing he's going to sex camp or whatever it is.
Sex camp. I'm pretty sure that's not what it's called.
Well, whatever. Who knows what they do there. He wasn't guilty until everything exploded, and then, you know, he, like, all these sponsors pull their money out, and he has this, like, reputation to fix, you know?
Well, no, that's a separate question. That's a question of, you know, if you never really regret what you've done.
I kind of know a lot of people feel, like, guilty. I don't know. It's hard to judge what people really feel.
Kind of guilty, but empty, like, empty. Meaning,
yeah,
look, all it's interesting, all those relationships we have with all those women...
I don't know if Elliot Spitzer felt bad.
But then what happened to all of those relationships? Each and every one of those women was more than happy to tell their story for money. Right? So obviously, there was nothing there.
Yeah.
Right?
I guess.
And, you know, meaning, what's his relationship with all of those women now? Right?
Zero.
Not only zero, but now they're his greatest enemies. Right? Because it was mutual using, it was all sorts of things. If anything... After all this, his wife is the one who potentially, who knows what's going to happen with them in the end, is potentially the only one he has any relationship with after all of that. So meaning, he could have gone chasing for 10 more years. I'm not saying you do it once and you realize your mistake.
But there are people that commit adultery and then they fall in love with the person and then they divorce their wife and then marry that other woman.
It's true. It does happen.
One that they... committed adultery with.
It's not the norm, but
it
does happen.
Actually, statistically, that's rarely ever a success.
Yeah, well, that really
I'm
happens.
I'm saying
but
that. I think it's...
In fact, what's his name? Dr. Phil. <We'll> say, his favorite saying is, if he cheated with you,
he'll cheat on
if
you.
If he did it with you, she will do it to you.
Right. That's right. Well, that's but right. I mean, but once a person has a mentality that marriage is flexible, then you're right. That's a hard mentality to break.
Rarely, if ever.
Right.
Ends up.
Now look, there are people who commit adultery but end up with very happy marriages and they're able to move on from it. But, I mean, I'm not saying one mistake, especially in this society, means the end of the marriage, means the end of everything. But it means that, but going in, people should have the mentality that they're chasing fool's gold. Meaning, when you're married especially, look, you have to be realistic. You have to be realistic with the Yitzhahara. The Yitzhahara does a lot of things. One of the things it does is try to convince you that there's something wrong with you, there's something wrong with your relationship, right? Just because you see a person and think they're attractive does not mean that there's something wrong with your marriage, right? Just because all sorts of thoughts enter people's minds doesn't mean that they are now cheating on someone, right? There's many steps that have to be taken. The key is being able to deal with what comes, all the Yetzirah throws at you, and then deal with it, put it in perspective, and then move on from it. That's really, you know, what you have to, that's where the test lies, is what happens when that, you know, when that stimulus happens. The more you're able to keep perspective and say, look, it's fool's gold, right? You know, the Yitzhar is trying to make me seem like this will make me happy, but ultimately it won't. You know, I mean, look, you just have to go down the line of how many people ruin their lives over things like this, and yeah, I'm not even getting into all the stories I've heard and I know and people I know personally. I'm not even getting into it, mm-hmm. But it almost never leads you to a better place, almost never, right? It just doesn't do it. Is it, you know? Have you ever seen the show To Catch a Predator? Mm-hmm. I love talking about this show. I don't know why I'm fascinated by this
show.
To Catch a Predator.
So actually, one of the women from that show.
The
yeah, there you go. You got it. What?
TV show?
Yeah. And then it's NBC, I think.
They asked to show, so they might have shown that.
What? Yeah, I think, I don't know if it's still on, but it was on for
it was
some
on
time.
For
yeah. Yeah, well, one of the women who worked for that show is now speaking at the internet conference. She.
Oh, wow, this is an exciting conference.
She works for Twitter now. Basically, she did two things. She worked for the government, I believe, and she was able to, like, pretend to be, you know, she pretended to be like the 13-year-old girl, you know, and
oh yeah, that's obvious.
Right.
It's
Well, I think
it's
that
it's not an entertaining show. It's a news magazine.
It's on Dateline. Yeah, it's on Dateline. Dateline NBC. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so and then she happens to be like really short and has a high pitched voice. So then she would pretend to be the 14-year-old girl, even though she's like in her 30s, right? Anyway. So watching that, it's very interesting because you see these men, and a few of them, these men are like either they'll say in their chats.
They're mostly a bunch of losers.
No, some of them are doctors.
Well, every sorts of everything, right?
Mostly,
but to me, the shocking thing to see is the before and after, right? When they walk into that room, they're confident and they're just obsessed with, right? The Yitzhahara is completely overtaking them. And, I mean, there's nowhere good this can go, right? They're literally, I mean, there's doctors, there are successful people with families and jobs who literally were risking their entire lives by walking into that door.
There was a rabbi there, too.
Yeah, that's right? And you see their face the moment Chris Hansen walks in that room, mm-hmm. right? And says, what are you doing here? and the look in their face when they realize that they've been tricked. Not just that they've been tricked by the show, which they have been, but they tricked themselves, right? Mm-hmm. Because all it takes is a small dose of reality to realize that your Yetzirah basically had you in complete control, mm-hmm. and just led you down this road to nowhere, and now it's over, right? And I mean. And the look of despair and hopelessness. And one of the first things they'll say, my life is over. My life is over. That's one of the first things they always say. Right? My life is over. Oh my God. I've lost. I'm going to lose everything. And that dose of reality. But so the more you can have that dose of reality in your head, before you walk into that door, right? Whatever that door is,
well,
then
you shouldn't be even near that door.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Well,
I'm saying
the moment
the thought enters your mind to do whatever, the quicker you can see yourself saying, "My life is over," that's when you stop, right? But that's a part of this, is that when you get suckered into the fool's gold of, I'll be happier if, right? I'll be happier if I'm with somebody else. Oh, X and Y is wrong with my spouse, and therefore I need somebody else because they're not fulfilling this need or that need, or they don't communicate, right? And the easy way out, very often the easy way out is, so therefore I will look for somebody else, right? That's the easy way out. It's much easier to look for somebody else than to work through a difficulty in a relationship. It's a much easier way out. But the more you can think it through and say, hey, look, that's ultimately, you know, I was reading about the studies of people who committed suicide jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. Right?
That movie?
Oh, there's a movie about it?
A documentary?
A movie called The Bridge.
No. Yeah. Oh, yeah? Mm-hmm. I haven't seen it. I was reading this.
What's the movie?
It's called The Bridge, I think.
Right, the Golden Gate Bridge, I think, is the most...
romantic.
Right. It's the biggest suicide point in the country.
In the world?
The country, the world. It's certainly in the country. So some people survive the jump,
yeah.
Right? There are people who
yeah,
survive
that's
it.
What the movie's about.
Right.
The documentary.
Yeah. So one guy, he's quoted as saying, so that's something. So what goes through your mind the moment you jump until you land, right? Those couple seconds, right? So he said, the moment I jumped, I realized everything else in my life I could fix except for the fact that I just jumped, right? Because once, you know, it seems impossible until...
It's a permanent solution for a temporary problem.
Right, right. So, all right, we'll stop with that on that note.